structure. Because life isn't simply made of the things we do, but the things we don't do too. And every moment of our life is a kind of turning. Still nothing. Think about it. Think about how we start off as this set thing, like the seed of a tree planted in the ground. And then we grow. We grow, and at first we are a trunk. Absolutely nothing. But then the tree that is our life, develops branches. And think of all those branches departing from the trunk at different heights. And think of all those branches branching off again, heading in often opposite directions. Think of those branches becoming other branches and those becoming twigs. And think of the end of each of those twigs, all in different places, having started from the same one. A life is like that, but on a bigger scale. New branches are formed every second of every day. And from our perspective, from everyone's perspective, it feels like a continuum. Each twig has traveled only one journey, but there are still other twigs. And there are also other todays, other lives that would have been different if you'd taken different directions earlier in your life. This is a tree of life. Lots of religions and mythologies have talked about the tree of life. It's there in Buddhism, Judaism, and Christianity. Lots of philosophers and writers have talked about tree metaphors too. For Sylvia Plath, existence was a fig tree, and each possible life she could live, the happily married one, the successful poet one, was this sweet, juicy fig. But she couldn't get to taste the sweet, juicy figs, and so they just rotted right in front of her. It can drive you insane, thinking of all the other lives we don't live. For instance, in most of my lives, I am not standing at this podium talking to you about success. In most lives, I am not an Olympic gold medalist. She remembered something Mrs. Elm had told her in the Midnight Library. You see, doing one thing differently is often the same as doing everything differently. Actions can't be reversed within a lifetime, however much we try. People were listening now. They clearly needed a Mrs. Elm in their lives. The only way to learn is to live. And she went on in this manner for another 20 minutes, remembering as much as possible of what Mrs. Elm had told her. And then she looked down at her hands glowing white from the light of the lectern. As she absorbed the sight of a raised, thin, pink line of flesh, she knew the scar was self-inflicted. And it put her off her flow, or rather, put her into a new one. And the thing is, what we consider to be the most successful route for us to take actually isn't. Because too often our view of success is about some external bullshit idea of achievement, an Olympic medal, the ideal husband, a good salary. And we have all these metrics that we try and reach, when really success isn't something you measure, and life isn't a race you can win. It's all bollocks, actually. The audience definitely looked uncomfortable now. Clearly, this is not the speech they were expecting. She scanned the crowd and saw a single face smiling up at her. It took a second. Given the fact that he was smartly dressed in a blue cotton shirt and with hair far shorter than it was in his Bedford life, for her to realize it was Ravi. This Ravi looked friendly, but she couldn't shake the knowledge of the other Ravi, the one who had stormed out of the newsagent, sulking about not being able to afford a magazine and blaming her for it. You see, I know you were expecting my TED talk on the path to success, but the truth is that success is a delusion. It's all a delusion. I mean, yes, there are things we can overcome. For instance, I am someone who gets stage fright, And yet, here I am, on a stage. Look at me, on a stage. And someone told me recently, they told me that my problem isn't actually stage fright. My problem is life fright. And you know what? They're fucking right. Because life is frightening. And it is frightening for a reason. And the reason is that it doesn't matter which branch of a life we get to live, we are always the same rotten tree. I wanted to be many things in my life, all kinds of things. But if your life is rotten, it will be rotten no matter what you do. The damp rots the whole useless thing. Joe was desperately slicing his hand in the air around his neck, making a cut it gesture. Anyway, just be kind. And just be kind. I have a feeling I'm about to go. So I would just like to say I love my brother, Joe. I love you, brother. And I love everyone in this room. And it was very nice to be here. And the moment she had said it was nice to be there was also the moment she wasn't there at all. System error. She arrived back in the midnight library. But this time she was a little away from the bookshelves. This was the loosely defined office area she had glimpsed earlier in one of the broader corridors. The desk was covered with administrative trays barely containing scattered piles of papers and boxes, and the computer. The computer was a really old-fashioned looking, cream-coloured boxy one on the desk by the papers, the kind that Mrs. Elm would once have had in her school library. She was at the keyboard now, typing with urgency, staring at the monitor as Nora stood behind her. The lights above, the same bare light bulbs hanging down from wires, were flickering wildly. My dad was alive because of me, but he'd also had an affair and my mum died earlier, and I got on with my brother because I'd never let him down, but he was still the same brother, really, and he was only really okay with me in that life because I was helping him make money, and it wasn't the Olympic dream I imagined. It was the same me. And something had happened in Portugal. I'd probably tried to kill myself or something. Are there any other lives at all, or is it just the furnishings that change? But Mrs. Elm wasn't listening. Nora noticed something on the desk. An old plastic orange fountain pen. The exact same kind that Nora had once owned at school. Hello? Mrs. Elm, can you hear me? Something was wrong. The librarian's face was tight with worry. She read from the screen to herself. System error. Mrs. Elm? Hello? Yoo-hoo! Can you see me? She tapped her shoulder. That seemed to do it. Mrs. Elm's face broke out in massive relief as she turned away from the computer. Oh, Nora. You got here. Were you expecting me not to? Did you think that life would be the one I wanted to live? She shook her head without really moving it, if that was possible. No, it's not that. It's just that it looked fragile. What looked fragile? The transfer. Transfer? From the book to here. The life you chose to here. It seems there is a problem. A problem with the whole system. Something beyond my immediate control. Something external. You mean in my actual life? She stared back at the screen. Yes. You see, the Midnight Library only exists because you do. In your root life. So I'm dying. Mrs. Elm looked exasperated. It's a possibility. That is to say, it's a possibility that we are reaching the end of possibility. Nora thought of how good it had felt, swimming in the pool. How vital and alive. And then something happened inside her. A strange feeling. A pull in her stomach. A physical shift. A change in her. The idea of death suddenly troubled her. At that same time, the light stopped flickering overhead and shone brightly. Mrs. Elm clapped her hands as she absorbed new information on the computer screen. Oh, it's back. Oh, that's good. The glitch is gone. We're running again. Thanks, I believe, to you. What? Well, the computer says the root cause within the host has been temporarily fixed. And you are the root cause. You are the host. She smiled. Nora blinked. And when she opened her eyes, both she and Mrs. Elm were standing in a different part of the library, between stacks of bookshelves again, standing, stiffly, awkwardly, facing each other. Right. Now, settle, said Mrs. Elm, before releasing a deep and meaningful exhale. She was clearly talking to herself. My mum died on different dates in different lives. I'd like a life where she is still here. Does that life exist? Mrs. Elm's attention switched to Nora. Maybe it does. Great. But you can't get there. Why not? Because this library is about your decisions. There was no choice you could have made that led to her being alive beyond yesterday. I'm sorry. A light bulb flickered above Nora's head, but the rest of the library stayed as it was. You need to think about something else, Nora. What was good about the last life? Nora nodded. Swimming. I like swimming. But I don't think I was happy in that life. I don't know if I am truly happy in any life. Is happiness the aim? I don't know. I suppose I want my life to mean something. I want to do something good. You once wanted to be a glaciologist, Mrs. Elm appeared to remember. Yeah. You used to talk about it. You said you were interested in the Arctic, so I suggested you become a glaciologist. I remember. I liked the sound of it straight away. My mum and dad never liked the idea, though. Why? I don't really know. They encouraged swimming. Well, Dad did. But anything that involved academic work, they were funny about. Nora felt a deep sadness down in her stomach. From her arrival into life, she was considered by her parents in a different way to her brother. Other than swimming, Joe was the one expected to pursue things, she told Mrs. Elm. My mum put me off anything that could take me away. Unlike Dad, she didn't even push me to swim. But surely there must be a life where I didn't listen to my mum and where I am now an Arctic researcher, far away from everything, with a purpose, helping the planet, researching the impact of climate change on the front line. So you want me to find that life for you? Nora sighed. She still had no idea what she wanted. But at least the Arctic Circle would be different. All right. Yes. Svalbard. She woke in a small bed in a little cabin on a boat. She knew it was a boat because it was rocking. And indeed the rocking, gentle as it was, had woken her up. The cabin was spare and basic. She was wearing a thick fleece sweater and long johns. Pulling back the blanket, she noticed that she had a headache. Her mouth was so dry, her cheeks felt sucked in against her teeth. She coughed a deep, chesty cough, and felt a million pool lengths away from the body of an Olympian. Her fingers smelt of tobacco. She sat up to see a pale blonde, robust, hard-weathered woman sitting on another bed staring at her. Good morgen, Nora. She smiled and hoped that in this life she wasn't fluent in whichever Scandinavian language this woman spoke. Good morning. She noticed a half-empty bottle of vodka and a mug on the floor beside the woman's bed. A dog calendar, April, Springer Spaniel, was propped up on the chest between the beds. The three books on top of it were all in English. The one nearest to the woman said, Principles of Glacier Mechanics. Two on Nora's, A Naturalist's Guide to the Arctic, and a Penguin Classic edition of The Saga of the Volsungs, the Norse epic of Sigurd the Dragonslayer. She noticed something else. It was cold. Properly cold. The cold that almost burns, that hurts your fingers and toes and stiffens your cheeks. Even inside. With layers of thermal underwear. With a sweater on. With the bars of two electric heaters glowing orange. Every exhale made a cloud. Why are you here, Nora? The woman asked in heavily accented English. A tricky question when you didn't know where here was. A bit early in the morning, isn't it? For philosophy? Nora laughed nervously. She saw a wall of ice outside the porthole rising out of the sea. She was either very far north or very far south. She was very far somewhere. The woman was still staring at her. Nora had no idea if they were friends or not. The woman seemed tough, direct, earthy, but probably an interesting form of company. I don't mean philosophy. I don't even mean what got you into glaciological research, although it might be the same thing. I mean, why did you choose to go as far away from civilization as possible? You never told me. I don't know, she said. I like the cold. No one likes this cold, unless they are a sadomasochist. She had a point. Nora reached for the sweater at the end of her bed and put it on, over the sweater she was already wearing. As she did, she saw, beside the vodka bottle, a laminated lanyard lying on the floor. Ingrid Skerbeck, Professor of Geoscience, International Polar Research Institute. I don't know, Ingrid. I just like glaciers, I suppose. I want to understand them. Why they are melting. She wasn't sounding like a glacier expert, judging from Ingrid's raised eyebrows. What about you? She asked hopefully. Ingrid sighed, rubbed her palm with a thumb. After Per died, I couldn't stand to be in Oslo anymore. All those people that weren't him, you know. There was this coffee shop we used to go to at the university. We just sit together. Together but silent. Happy silent. Reading newspapers. Drinking coffee. It was hard to avoid places like that. We used to walk around everywhere. His troublesome soul lingered on every street. I kept telling his memory to piss the fuck off, but it wouldn't. Grief is a bastard. If I'd have stayed any longer, I'd have hated humanity. So when a research position came up in Svalbard, I was like, yes, this has come to save me. I wanted to be somewhere he had never been. I wanted somewhere where I didn't have to feel his ghost. But the truth is, it only half works, you know. Places are places, and memories are memories, and life is fucking life. Nora took all this in. Ingrid was clearly telling this to someone she thought she knew reasonably well, and yet Nora was a stranger. It felt odd, wrong. This must be the hardest bit about being a spy, she thought. The emotion people store in you, like a bad investment. You feel like you are robbing people of something. Ingrid smiled, breaking the thought. Anyway, thanks for last night. That was a good chat. There are a lot of dickheads on this boat, and you are not a dickhead. Oh, thanks. Neither are you. And it was then that Nora noticed the gun. A large rifle with a hefty brown handle, leaning against the wall at the far end of the room under the coat hooks. The sight made her feel happy, somehow. Made her feel like her 11-year-old self would have been proud. She was, it seemed, having an adventure. Hugo Lefebvre. Nora walked with her headache and obvious hangover through an undecorated wooden passageway to a small dining hall that smelled of pickled herring and where a few research scientists were having breakfast. She got herself a black coffee and some stale, dry rye bread and sat down. Around her, outside the window, was the most eerily beautiful sight she had ever seen. Islands of ice, like rocks rendered clean and pure white, were visible amid the fog. There were 17 other people in the dining hall, Nora counted. 11 men, 6 women. Nora sat by herself, but within 5 minutes a man with short hair and stubble 2 days away from a full beard sat down at her table. He was wearing a parka, like most of the room, but he seemed ill-suited to it, as if he would be more at home on the Riviera wearing designer shorts and a pink polo shirt. He smiled at Nora. She tried to translate the smile, to understand the kind of relationship they had. He watched her for a little while, then shuffled his chair along to sit opposite her. She looked for a lanyard, but he wasn't wearing one. She wondered if she should know his name. "I'm Hugo," he said, to her relief. "Hugo Lefebvre. You are Nora, yes?"
"Yes. I saw you around, in Svalbard, at the research center, but we never said hello. Anyway, I just wanted to say I read your paper on pulsating glaciers, and it blew my mind."
"Really?"
"Yes. I mean, it's always fascinated me, why they do that here and nowhere else. It's such a strange phenomenon."
"Life is full of strange phenomena."
Conversation was tempting, but dangerous. Nora smiled a small, polite smile and then looked out of the window. The islands of ice turned into actual islands, little snow-streaked pointed hills like the tips of mountains or flatter, craggy plates of land. And beyond them, the glacier Nora had seen from the cabin porthole. She could get a better measure of it now, although its top portion was concealed under a visor of cloud. Other parts of it were entirely free from fog. It was incredible. You see a picture of a glacier on TV or in a magazine and you see a smooth lump of white. But this was as textured as a mountain. Black, brown and white. And there were infinite varieties of that white, a whole visual smorgasbord of variation. White-white, blue-white, turquoise-white, gold-white, silver-white, translucent white, rendered glaringly alive and impressive. Certainly more impressive than the breakfast.
"Depressing, isn't it?" Hugo said.
"What?"
"The fact that the day never ends."
Nora felt uneasy with this observation.
"In what sense?"
He waited a second before responding.
"The never-ending light," he said, before taking a bite of a dry cracker. "From April on, it's like living one interminable day. I hate that feeling."
"Tell me about it."
"You'd think they'd give the portholes curtains. Hardly slept since I've been on this boat."
Nora nodded.
"How long is that again?"
He laughed. It was a nice laugh. Close-mouthed, civilized. Hardly a laugh at all.
"I drank a lot with Ingrid last night. Vodka has stolen my memory."
"Are you sure it's the vodka?"
"What else would it be?"
His eyes were inquisitive and made Nora feel automatically guilty. She looked over at Ingrid, who was drinking her coffee and typing on her laptop. She wished she had sat with her now.
"Well, that was our third night," Hugo said. "We have been meandering around the archipelago since Sunday."
"Yeah, Sunday. That's when we left Longyearbyen."
Nora made a face as if to say she knew all this. Sunday seems forever away. The boat felt like it was turning,
Nora was forced to lean a little in her seat.
20 years ago, there was hardly any open water in Svalbard in April. Look at it now. It's like cruising in the Mediterranean.
Nora tried to make her smile seem relaxed.
Not quite. Anyway, I heard you got the short straw today.
Nora tried to look blank, which wasn't hard.
Really? You're the spotter, aren't you?
She had no idea what he was talking about, but feared the twinkle in his eye.
Yes, she answered. Yes, I am the spotter.
Hugo's eyes widened with shock. Or mock shock. It was hard to tell the difference with him.
The spotter?
Yes. Nora desperately wanted to know what the spotter actually did, but couldn't ask.
Well, bon chance, said Hugo with a testing gaze.
Merci, said Nora, staring out at the crisp Arctic light and a landscape she had only ever seen in magazines. I'm ready for a challenge.
Walking in circles. An hour later, and Nora was on an expanse of snow-covered rock. More of a skerry than an island. A place so small and uninhabitable it had no name. Though a larger island, ominously titled Bear Island, was visible across the ice-cold water. She stood next to a boat. Not the Lance, the large boat she'd had breakfast on. That was moored safely out at sea. But the small motor dinghy that had been dragged up out of the water almost single-handedly by a big boulder of a man called Rune, who, despite his Scandinavian name, spoke in languid West Coast American. At her feet was a fluorescent yellow rucksack, and lying on the ground was the Winchester rifle that had been leaning against the wall in the cabin. This was her gun. In this life, she owned a firearm. Next to the gun was a saucepan with a ladle inside it. In her hands was another, less deadly gun, a signal pistol ready to fire a flare. She had discovered what kind of spotting she was doing. While 9 of the scientists conducted a climate tracking fieldwork on this tiny island, she was the lookout for polar bears. Apparently this was a very real prospect, and if she saw one, the very first thing she had to do was fire the flare. This would serve the dual purpose of A, frightening the bear away, and B, warning the others. It was not foolproof. Humans were tasty protein sources, and the bears were not known for their fear, especially in recent years as the loss of habitat and food sources had made them ever more vulnerable and forced them to be more reckless.
Soon as you fired the flare, said the eldest of the group, a beardless, sharp-featured man called Peter, who was the field leader and who spoke in a state of permanent fortissimo. Bang the pan with a ladle. Bang it like mad and scream. They have sensitive hearing. They're like cats. 9 times out of 10, the noise scares them off.
And the other 10 out of 10?
He nodded down at the rifle.
You kill it before it kills you.
Nora wasn't the only one with a gun. They all had guns. They were armed scientists.
Anyway, Peter laughed and Ingrid patted her back.
I truly hope, said Ingrid, laughing raspily, you don't get eaten. I would miss you. So long as you aren't menstruating, you should be okay.
Jesus, what?
They can smell the blood from a mile away.
Another person, someone who was so thoroughly wrapped up it was impossible to tell who they were even if she had known them, wished her good luck in a muffled, faraway voice.
We'll be back in 5 hours, Peter told her.
He laughed again, and Nora hoped that meant it was a joke.
Walk in circles to keep warm.
And then they left her, walking off over the rocky ground and disappearing into the fog. For an hour, nothing happened. Nora walked in circles. She hopped from left foot to right foot. The fog thinned a little, and she stared out at the landscape. She wondered why she was not back in the library. After all, this was definitely a bit shit. There were surely lives where she was sitting beside a swimming pool in the sunshine right now. Lives where she was playing music, or lying in a warm lavender-scented bath, or having incredible third-date sex, or reading on a beach in Mexico, or eating in a Michelin-starred restaurant, or strolling the streets of Paris, or getting lost in Rome, or tranquilly gazing at a temple near Kyoto, or feeling the warm cocoon of a happy relationship. In most lives, she would have at least been physically comfortable. And yet, she was feeling something new here, or something old that she had long buried. The glacial landscape reminded her that she was, first and foremost, a human living on a planet. Almost everything she had done in her life, she realized, almost everything she had bought and worked for and consumed, had taken her further away from understanding that she and all humans were really just one of 9 million species. If one advances confidently, Thoreau had written in Walden, in the direction of his dreams, and endeavors to live the life which he has imagined, he will meet with a success unexpected in common hours. He'd also observed that part of this success was the product of being alone. I never found the companion that was so companionable as solitude. And Nora felt similarly in that moment. Although she had only been left alone for an hour at this point, she'd never experienced this level of solitude before, amid such unpopulated nature. She had thought, in her nocturnal and suicidal hours, that solitude was the problem. But that was because it hadn't been true solitude. The lonely mind in the busy city yearns for connection, because it thinks human-to-human connection is the point of everything. But amid pure nature, or the tonic of wildness, as Thoreau called it, solitude took on a different character. It became in itself a kind of connection. A connection between herself and the world. And between her and herself. She remembered a conversation she'd had with Ash. Tall. And slightly awkward, and cute, and forever in need of a new songbook for his guitar. The chat hadn't been in the shop, but in the hospital, when her mother was ill. Shortly after discovering she had ovarian cancer, she had needed surgery. Nora had taken her mum to see all the consultants at Bedford General Hospital, and she had held her mum's hand more in those few weeks than in all the rest of their relationship put together. While her mum was undergoing surgery, Nora had waited in the hospital canteen, and Ash, in his scrubs and recognizing her as the person he'd chatted to on many occasions in string theory, saw she looked worried and popped in to say hi. He worked at the hospital as a general surgeon, and she'd ended up asking him lots of questions about the sort of stuff he did. On that particular day, he'd removed an appendix and a bile duct. She also asked about normal post-surgery recovery time and procedure times, and he had been very reassuring. They'd ended up talking for a very long time about all sorts of things, which he seemed to sense she'd been in need of. He'd said something about not over-Googling health symptoms, and that had led them to talking about social media. He believed that the more people were connected on social media, the lonelier society became. That's why everyone hates each other nowadays. He reckoned, because they are overloaded with non-friend friends. Ever heard about Dunbar's number? And then he had told her about a man called Roger Dunbar at Oxford University, who had discovered that human beings were wired to know only 150 people, as that was the average size of hunter-gatherer communities. And the Doomsday Book, Ash had told her, under the stark lighting of the hospital canteen. If you look at the Doomsday Book, the average size of an English community at that time was 150 people, except in Kent, where it was 100 people. I'm from Kent. We have antisocial DNA. I've been to Kent. Nora had countered. I noticed that. But I like that theory. I can meet that many people on Instagram in an hour.
Exactly. Not healthy. Our brains can't handle it,
which is why we crave face-to-face communication more than ever.
And
which is why I would never buy my Simon and Garfunkel guitar chord songbooks online.
She smiled at the memory and was brought back to the reality of the Arctic landscape by the sound of a loud splash. A few meters away from her, between the rocky skerry she was standing on and Bear Island, there was another little rock, or collection of rocks sticking out of the water. Something was emerging from the sea froth. Something heavy, slapping against the stone with a great wet weight. Her whole body shaking as she got ready to fire the flare. But it wasn't a polar bear. It was a walrus. The fat, brown, wrinkled beast shuffled over the ice, then stopped to stare at her. She, or he, looked old, even for a walrus. The walrus knew no shame and could hold a stare for an indefinite amount of time. Nora felt scared. She only knew two things about walruses: that they could be vicious and that they were never alone for very long. There were probably other walruses about to haul out of the water. She wondered if she should fire the flare. The walrus stayed where it was, like a ghost of itself in the grainy light, but slowly disappeared behind a veil of fog. Minutes went by. Nora had 7 layers of clothing on, but her eyelids felt like they were stiffening and could freeze shut if she closed them for too long. She heard the voices of the others occasionally drifting over to her, and, for a while, her colleagues returned close enough for her to see some of them. Silhouettes in the fog, hunched over the ground, reading ice samples with equipment she wouldn't have understood. But then they disappeared again. She ate one of the protein bars in her rucksack. It was cold and hard as toffee. She checked her phone, but there was no signal. It was very quiet. The quiet made her realize how much noise there was elsewhere in the world. Here, noise had meaning. You heard something and you had to pay attention. As she was chewing, there came another splashing sound, but this time from a different direction. The combination of fog and weak light made it hard to see, but it wasn't a walrus. That became clear when she realized the silhouette moving towards her was big. Bigger than a walrus, and much bigger than any human. A moment of extreme crisis in the middle of nowhere.
"Oh, fuck,"
whispered Nora into the cold. The frustration of not finding a library when you really need one. The fog cleared to reveal a huge white bear standing upright. It dropped down to all fours and continued moving toward her with surprising velocity and a heavy and terrifying grace. Nora did nothing. Her mind was jammed with panic. She was as still as the permafrost she stood on.
Fuck. Fuck, fuck. Fuck, fuck, fucking fuck. Fuck, 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 fuck.
Eventually, a survival impulse kicked in. And Nora raised the signal pistol and fired it, and the flare shot out like a tiny comet and disappeared into the water, the glow fading along with her hope. The creature was still coming towards her. She fell to her knees and started clanging the ladle against the saucepan and shouting at the top of her lungs.
Bear! Bear! Bear!
The bear stopped momentarily.
Bear! Bear!
It was now walking forward again. The banging wasn't working. The bear was close. She wondered if she could reach the rifle lying on the ice just slightly too far away. She could see the bear's vast, pawed feet, armed with claws, pressing into the snow-dusted rock. Its head was low, and its black eyes were looking directly at her,
library! Nora screamed. Mrs. Elm, please, send me back. This is the wrong life. It is really, really, really wrong. Take me back. I don't want adventure. Where's the library? I want the library.
There was no hatred in the polar bear's stare. Nora was just food. Meat. And that was a humbling kind of terror. Her heart pounded like a drummer reaching the crescendo. The end of the song. And it became astoundingly clear to her, finally, in that moment. She didn't want to die. And that was the problem. In the face of death, life seemed more attractive. And as life seemed more attractive, how could she get back to the Midnight Library? She had to be disappointed in a life, not just scared of it, in order to try again with another book. There was death. Violent, oblivious death in bare form staring at her with its black eyes. And she knew then, more than she'd known anything, that she wasn't ready to die. This knowledge grew bigger than fear itself as she stood there, face to face with a polar bear, itself hungry and desperate to exist, and banged the ladle against the saucepan. Harder. A fast staccato bang, bang, bang. I'm not scared. 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 The bear stood and stared the way the walrus had. She glanced at the rifle. Yes, it was too far away. By the time she could grab it and work out how to fire it would already be too late. She doubted she'd be able to kill a polar bear anyway. So she banged the ladle. Nora closed her eyes, wishing for the library as she carried on making noise. When she opened them, the bear was slipping headfirst into the water. She kept banging the saucepan even after the creature had disappeared. About a minute later, she heard the humans calling her name through the fog. Island. She was in shock. But it was a slightly different shock than the others on the dinghy assumed. It wasn't the shock of having been close to death. It was the shock of realizing she actually wanted to live. They passed a small island, teeming with nature. Green lichens spread over rocks. Birds, little auks and puffins clustered together, huddled against the Arctic wind. Life, surviving against the odds. Nora sipped the coffee that Hugo handed her, fresh from his flask, holding it with cold hands even under three pairs of gloves. To be part of nature was to be part of the will to live. When you stay too long in a place, you forget just how big an expanse the world is. You get no sense of the length of those longitudes and latitudes, just as, she supposed, it is hard to have a sense of the vastness inside any one person. But once you sense that vastness, once something reveals it, hope emerges, whether you want it to or not. And it clings to you as stubbornly as lichen clings to rock. Permafrost. The surface air temperatures in Svalbard were warming at twice the global rate. Climate change was happening faster here than almost anywhere on Earth. One woman, wearing a purple woolen hat pulled down over her eyebrows, talked about witnessing one of the icebergs doing a somersault. Something that happened apparently because the warming waters had dissolved it from beneath, causing it to become top-heavy. Another problem was that the permafrost on the land was thawing, softening the ground, leading to landslides and avalanches that could destroy the wooden houses of Longyearbyen, the largest town in Svalbard. There was also a risk of bodies surfacing in the local cemetery. It was inspiring. Being among these scientists who were trying to discover precisely what was happening to the planet. trying to observe glacial and climatic activity, and in so doing to inform and to protect life on Earth. Back on the main boat, Nora sat quietly in the dining area as everyone offered sympathy for the bear encounter. She felt unable to tell them she was grateful for the experience. She just smiled politely and did her best to avoid conversation. This life was an intense one, without compromise. It was currently minus 17 degrees, and she had nearly been eaten by a polar bear. And yet maybe the problem with her root life had partly been its blandness. She had come to imagine mediocrity and disappointment were her destiny. Indeed, Nora had always had the sense that she came from a long line of regrets and crushed hopes that seemed to echo in every generation. For instance, her grandfather on her mother's side was called Lorenzo Conte. He had left Puglia, the handsome heel in the boot of Italy, to come to swinging London in the 1960s. Like other men in the desolate port town of Brindisi, he'd emigrated to Britain, exchanging life on the Adriatic for a job at the London Brick Company. Lorenzo, in his naivety, had imagined having a wonderful life, making bricks all day, and then of an evening he would rub shoulders with the Beatles and walk arm in arm down Carnaby Street with Jean Shrimpton or Marianne Faithfull. The only problem was that, despite its name, the London Brick Company wasn't actually in London. It was based 60 miles north in Bedford, which, for all its modest charms, turned out not to be as swinging as Lorenzo would have liked. But he made a compromise with his dreams and settled there. The work may not have been glamorous, but it paid. Lorenzo married a local English woman called Patricia Brown, who was also getting used to life's disappointments, having exchanged her dream of being an actress for the mundane, daily theatre of the suburban housewife, and whose culinary skills were forever under the ghostly shadow of her dead Puglian mother-in-law and her legendary spaghetti dishes, which, in Lorenzo's eyes, could never be surpassed. They had a baby within a year of getting married, Nora's mother, and they called her Donna. Donna grew up with her parents arguing almost continually, and had consequently believed marriage was something that was not only inevitable, but also inevitably miserable. She became a secretary at a law firm, and then a communications officer for Bedford Council. But then she'd had an experience which was never really discussed, at least not with Nora. She'd experienced some kind of breakdown, the first of several, that caused her to stay at home, and although she recovered, she never went back to work. There was an invisible baton of failure her mother had passed down, and Nora had held it for a long time. Maybe that was why she'd given up on so many things, because she had it written in her DNA that she had to fail. Nora thought of this as the boat chugged through the Arctic waters and gulls, black-legged kittiwakes, according to Ingrid, flew overhead. On both sides of her family, there had been an unspoken belief that life was meant to fuck you over. Nora's dad, Jeff, had certainly lived a life that seemed to miss its target. He had grown up with only a mother, as his dad had died of a heart attack when he was 2, cruelly hiding somewhere behind his first memories. Nora's paternal grandmother had been born in rural Ireland, but emigrated to England to become a school cleaner, struggling to bring in enough money for food, let alone anything approaching fun. Jeff had been bullied early on in life, but had grown big and broad enough to easily put those bullies in their place. He worked hard and proved good at football and the shot put, and in particular rugby. He played for the Bedford Blues youth team, becoming their best player, and had a shot at the big time before a collateral ligament injury stopped him in his tracks. He then became a PE teacher and simmered with quiet resentment at the universe. He forever dreamed of travel, but never did much of it beyond a subscription to National Geographic and the occasional holiday to somewhere in the Cyclades. Nora remembered him in Naxos, snapping a picture of the Temple of Apollo at sunset. Maybe that's what all lives were, though. Maybe even the most seemingly perfectly intense or worthwhile lives ultimately felt the same. Acres of disappointment and monotony, and hurts and rivalries, but with flashes of wonder and beauty. Maybe that was the only meaning that mattered. To be the world, witnessing itself. Maybe it wasn't the lack of achievements that had made her and her brother's parents unhappy. Maybe it was the expectation to achieve in the first place. She had no idea about any of it, really. But on that boat, she realized something. She had loved her parents more than she ever knew. And right then, she forgave them completely. One night in Longyearbyen. It took 2 hours to get back to the tiny port at Longyearbyen. It was Norway's and the world's most northern town, with a population of around 2,000 people. Nora knew these basic things from her route life. She had, after all, been fascinated by this part of the world since she was 11. But her knowledge didn't stretch far beyond the magazine articles she had read, and she was still nervous of talking. But the boat trip back had been okay, because her inability to discuss the rock and ice and plant samples they had taken, or to understand phrases such as striated basalt bedrock and post-glacial isotopes, was put down to the shock of her polar bear encounter. And she was in the kind of shock. It was true. But it was not the shock her colleagues were imagining. The shock hadn't been that she thought she'd been about to die. She had been about to die ever since she first entered the Midnight Library. No, the shock was that she felt like she was about to live. Or at least that she could imagine wanting to be alive again. And she wanted to do something good with that life. The life of a human, according to the Scottish philosopher David Hume, was of no greater importance to the universe than that of an oyster. But if it was important enough for David Hume to write that thought down, then maybe it was important enough to aim to do something good, to help preserve life in all its forms. As Nora understood it, the work this other Nora and her fellow scientists had been doing was something to do with determining the speed at which the ice and glaciers had been melting in the region to gauge the acceleration rate of climate change. There was more to it than that, but that was at the core of it, as far as Nora could see. So, in this life, she was doing her bit to save the planet. Or at least to monitor the steady devastation of the planet in order to alert people to the facts of environmental crisis. That was potentially depressing, but also a good and ultimately fulfilling thing to do, she imagined. There was purpose. There was meaning. They were impressed, too, the others, with the polar bear story. Nora was a hero of sorts, not in an Olympic swimming champion way, but in another equally fulfilling kind of fashion. Ingrid had her arm around her. You are the saucepan warrior, and I think we need to mark your fearlessness and our potentially groundbreaking findings with a meal. A nice meal, and some vodka. What do you say, Peter? A nice meal, in Longyearbyen. Do they have them? As it turned out, they did. Back on dry land, they went to a smart wooden shack of a place called Gruvelagret, perched off a lonely road in an austere, snow-crisp valley. She drank Arctic ale and surprised her colleagues by eating the only vegan option on a menu that included reindeer steak and moose burger. Nora must have looked tired, because quite a few of her colleagues told her that she did. But maybe it was just that there weren't many places in the conversation that she could enter with confidence. She felt like a learner driver at a busy junction, nervously waiting for a clear and safe patch of road. Hugo was there. He still looked to her like he would rather be in Antibes or Saint-Tropez. She felt a little uneasy as he stared at her. A little too observed. On the hurried walk back to their land-based accommodation, which reminded Nora of a university halls of residence, but on a smaller scale, and more Nordic and wooden and minimal. Hugo jogged to catch her up and walk by her side.
It is interesting, he said.
What is interesting?
How at breakfast this morning you didn't know who I was?
Why? You didn't know who I was either.
Of course I did. We were chatting for about 2 hours yesterday.
Nora felt like she was inside some kind of trap.
We were?
I studied you at breakfast before I came over and I could see you were different today.
That's creepy, Hugo. Studying women at breakfast.
And I noticed things.
Nora lifted her scarf over her face.
It's too cold. Can we talk about this tomorrow?
I noticed you improvising. All day you have been non-committal in everything you say.
Not true. I'm just shook up, you know. The bear.
Non, ce n'est pas ça. I'm talking about before the bear, and after the bear, and all day.
I have no idea what you...
There is a look. I have seen it before in other people. I'd recognize it anywhere.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Why do glaciers pulsate?
What?
This is your area of study. It's why you're here, isn't it?
The science isn't entirely settled on the matter.
Okay, bien. Name me one of the glaciers around here.
Glaciers have names. Name one.
Kongsbreen, Nathosbreen. Ring any bells?
I don't want this conversation.
Because you aren't the same person you were yesterday, are you?
None of us are, said Nora briskly. Our brains change. It's called neuroplasticity. Please stop mansplaining glaciers to a glaciologist, Hugo.
Hugo seemed to retreat a little and she felt a bit guilty.
There was a minute of silence, just the crunch of their feet in the snow. They were nearly back at the accommodation, the others not too far behind them. But then, he said it.
I am like you, Nora. I visit lives that aren't mine. I have been in this one for 5 days, but I have been in many others. I was given an opportunity, a rare opportunity, for this to happen. I have been sliding between lives for a long while.
Ingrid grabbed Nora's arm. I still have some vodka, she announced as they reached the door. She held her keycard in her glove and tapped it against the scanner. The door opened.
Listen, Hugo mumbled conspiratorially. If you want to know more, meet me in the communal kitchen in 5 minutes.
And Nora felt her heart race. But this time she had no ladle or saucepan to bang. She didn't particularly like this Hugo character, but was far too intrigued not to hear what he had to say. And she also wanted to know if he could be trusted.
Okay, she said.
I'll be there. Expectation. Nora had always had a problem accepting herself. From as far back as she could remember, she'd had the sense that she wasn't enough. Her parents, who both had their own insecurities, had encouraged that idea. She imagined now what it would be like to accept herself completely. Every mistake she had ever made, every mark on her body, every dream she hadn't reached or pain she had felt. Every lust or longing she had suppressed. She imagined accepting it all. The way she accepted nature. The way she accepted a glacier or a puffin or the breach of a whale. She imagined seeing herself as just another brilliant freak of nature. Just another sentient animal trying their best. And in doing so, she imagined what it was like to be free. Life and death and the quantum wave function. With Hugo, it wasn't a library. It's a video store, he said, leaning against the cheap-looking cupboard where the coffee was kept. It looks exactly like a video store I used to go to on the outskirts of Lyon. Video Lumière, where I grew up. The Lumière brothers are heroes in Lyon, and there's lots of things named after them. They invented cinema there. Anyway, that is beside the point. The point is that every life I choose is an old VHS that I play right in the store. And the moment it starts, the moment the movie starts, is the moment I disappear. Nora suppressed a giggle. What's so funny? Hugo wondered, a little hurt.
Nothing. Nothing at all. It just seemed mildly amusing.
A video store. Oh, and a library that is entirely sensible?
More sensible, yes. I mean, at least you can still use books. Who plays videos these days?
Interesting. I had no idea there was such a thing as between life snobbery. You are in education. Sorry, Hugo. Okay, I will ask a sensible question. Is there anyone else there? A person who helps you choose each life? He nodded. Oh, yeah. It's my Uncle Philippe. He died years ago, and he never even worked in a video store. It's so illogical. Nora told him about Mrs. Elm. A school librarian? Mocked Hugo. That's pretty funny, too. Nora ignored him. Do you reckon they're ghosts? Guiding spirits? Guardian angels? What are they? It felt so ludicrous in the heart of a scientific facility to be talking like this. They are, Hugo gestured, as if trying to pluck the right term from the air. An interpretation. Interpretation? I have met others like us, Hugo said. You see, I have been in the in-between state for a long time. I have encountered a few other sliders. That's what I call them. Us. We are sliders. We have a root life in which we are lying somewhere, unconscious, suspended between life and death. And then we arrive in a place. And it is always something different. A library, a video store, an art gallery, a casino, a restaurant. What does that tell you? Nora shrugged and thought, listening to the hum of the central heating. That it's all bullshit? That none of this is real? No. Because the template is always the same. For instance, there is always someone else there. A guide. Only ever one person. They are always someone who has helped the person at a significant time in their life. The setting is always somewhere with emotional significance, and there is usually talk of root lives or branches. Nora thought about being consoled by Mrs. Elm when her dad died. Staying with her. Comforting her. It was probably the most kindness anyone had ever shown her. And there is always an infinite range of choices. Hugo went on. An infinite number of videotapes or books or paintings or meals. Now, I am a scientist. And I've lived many scientific lives. In my original root life, I have a degree in biology. I have also, in another life, been a Nobel Prize-winning chemist. I have been a marine biologist trying to protect the Great Barrier Reef. But my weakness was always physics. At first, I had no idea of how to find out what was happening to me. Until I met a woman in one life who was going through what we are going through. And in her root life, she was a quantum physicist. Professor Dominique Bisset at Montpellier University. She explained it all to me. The many worlds interpretation of quantum physics. So that means we... A kind, pink-skinned, auburn-bearded man whose name Nora didn't know, came into the kitchen to rinse a coffee cup, then smiled at them.
See you tomorrow, he said, in a soft American, maybe Canadian accent, before padding away in his slippers.
Yes, said Nora.
See you, said Hugo, before returning in a more hushed tone to his main thread.
The universal wave function is real, Nora. That's what Professor Bissett said.
What?
Hugo held up a finger. A slightly annoying, wait-a-minute kind of finger. Nora resisted a strong urge to grab it and twist it.
Erwin Schrödinger.
He of the cat.
Yes, the cat guy. He said that in quantum physics, every alternative possibility happens simultaneously.
All at once. In the same place.
Quantum superposition.
The cat in the box is both alive and dead. You could open the box and see that it was alive or dead. That's how it goes. But in one sense, even after the box is open, the cat is still both alive and dead. Each universe exists over every other universe. Like a million pictures on tracing paper, all with slight variations within the same frame. The many worlds interpretation of quantum physics